The caravan master was a short, balding man who looked like he had seen all manner of businessman, adventurer, and monster that this world had to throw at him. And he didn't care for any of them. Wearing a permanent scowl, the salt-and-pepper bearded gent could be seen pacing in front of the lead wagon. When he figured everyone was here, he started to bellow.
"We have a few new people on this trip, so listen up. I'm saying this once, then I expect you to do your damned job. In the rear wagon, we've left space for our two archers. They got pointy ears, you can't really miss them. The two middle wagons have our complement of frontline fighters, so if we circle the wagons in an emergency, one of you drops out every couple of seconds, so we have decent coverage all round. In the second wagon, we have our three mages, protected by this large piece of beef with horns."
I glanced around. I spotted the two elves keeping to themselves near the very back of the gathering. The fighters were mostly in heavy leathers or light chainmail. All of them had swords or axes, and a couple of them also had wicked-looking crossbows. They were a fairly well-equipped crew. The caravan master continued.
"If anyone sees anything fishy, you should shout out danger and the direction. The more eyes we got on it, the quicker we figure out what it is. Do your shouting in common, 'cause I don't speak Entish. If anyone gets hurt, and that means guards or civvies, medical supplies are in the center wagon. One of our non-combatants, Sister Janet, will try to make you not die. If you die, we'll drop your body and all of your crap off at the endpoint designated in your contract. Questions?"
Rick called out, "Miles, what's the loot protocol for anything stupid enough to be killed by us?" The man nodded curtly.
"If we're running, leave all of their crap behind and get your asses back to your wagons. If we've stopped, drag everything into one big pile. I'll manage the loot order and arrange for the bodies to be burnt. Anything left that I think I can sell, I'll buy at wholesale discount and you idiots split the proceeds. Everything else burns. Other questions?"
There were no other questions. The caravan master called Miles, or so Rick had mentioned, waved his hand dismissively at us, and then ambled off to sign some papers. His assistant had been waving the documents at him urgently at the end of his inspirational speech. I assumed they were things that needed to get done before the important company member disappeared for several weeks. I followed Will and Rick's lead, as did Toby, who ambled behind us at an easy gait. First, we stopped by one of the supply wagons to get our day's rations and water. Will mentioned,
"When we stop for the night, the company appreciates any foraging or hunting you can do, mostly because people get sick of the same dried fruit and jerky over and over again. With 25 wagons, there's a lot of mouths to feed, with 13 guards, just as many non-combatants, if not more, and over twice as many crew. You're looking at over 70 people on this trip, not to mention 100 or so horses. You can't split a stag 70 ways, but if everyone does their part, we'll be in good shape when the lean section of the journey hits."
As we all climbed up into the back of our wagon, which had already been loaded with our gear and the magic shop's shipment, Rick said,
"When we approach the middle part of the journey, everything gets scarce. It's the dead zone between the ruins of Castle Grey and the mountains. There are only a few safe watering holes and not much grazing for the horses. The fewer supplies we can use before we hit the snow, the better. After that, there's plenty of snow to melt for water, and a fair amount of hunting and trapping can be done."
When Toby got aboard, there was a noticeable creaking. We all held our breath until the big man bull had settled in. He glanced over at the three of us.
"Oh, come on! When was the last time I broke a wagon?"
He added quickly,
"By accident!"
Will's smart-ass reply was cut short by the wise clarification from our bovine companion. I chuckled. There was a story there which I would have to ask about when the time was right. The first couple of days on the road were uneventful. I was quickly learning what it meant to be part of a caravan. By necessity, one had to be a jack-of-all-trades as well as the master of at least one. Just because I was one of the hired guards, I wasn't excused from menial labor. Whenever the wagons were stopped, I was expected to participate in vehicle inspection, livestock feeding, fire building, hunting and gathering, and all manner of small chores. In a way, that was good for me. It made me feel connected to the overall endeavor. I was part of a team. While traveling those first few days, I satisfied Toby's curiosity about my background. He wanted detailed knowledge about being an orc, from life in a tribe or clan, to diet, to work habits, to warfare. I answered every question to the best of my ability. Even Rick and Will learned a few new things about me and my clan. By midday of the third day, I had finally run the paladin out of questions. When he announced that his curiosity was satisfied, there was a sarcastic round of applause from the two humans. I told Toby that he could expect to be grilled when we bedded down for the night. The Minotaur assured me that when his turn came for answering questions, he would do so with equal verbosity and candor. The hunting and foraging was particularly good that night. Our elven rearguard had caught two stags, there were a number of rabbits caught by the warriors, and our group managed to find a hillside that had dozens of wild potatoes. When the caravan master wandered by, he said it was the finest haul that he'd seen in the last year. As he was walking away, he noted that the road quickly became desolate from this point on, and not to get used to such a bounty. Will stared daggers at the back of Miles's head.
"He's always good for a laugh, isn't he?" the small mage asked, acidically.
Rick patted his partner on the back.
"Ignore him. He's a good guy, but if he didn't look for the downside of things, he probably wouldn't have a business left. That's just his nature."
With the contributions of the staff and the civilians, from wild berries to roasted squirrels, everyone ate well. Sister Janet blessed the feast and delivered a little speech about the importance of community. There was genuine applause afterwards. Rick murmured in my ear,
"Sister Janet has been a part of well over 100 of these caravan trips. The regulars know her better than their own family."
I looked at the older human's weathered face. It was a road map of the world. Wrinkles, scars, and leathery patches from being out in the sun far too often. But under all of that was an undeniable joy. It was something I would like someday. That sense of community, of caring for something greater than yourself and your little circle of friends. Someday. Our group broke away from the main campfire to relax after the big meal. I took out my self-heating pot and filled it with some water. I could brew some strong tea and keep the four of us nice and warm at the same time. Once the brewing process was underway, Toby broke the silence. The Minotaur said,
"So, Sort, you've had all day to think of questions for me. What would you like to start with?"
My answer was immediate. "Could you tell me about the Elflands?" Will and Rick murmured their approval. It was a topic that they enjoyed. Toby nodded. He leaned back against a wagon wheel and stretched his legs, hooves digging slight furrows into the dirt.
"Of course. There are two major elf nations. Sevilia is where I hail from. Past the mountains and far to the northwest, Sevilia is said to be the birthplace of magic on Panos. I believe it. The structures are drawn directly from the earth by magic. Great crystalline towers and obsidian bridges. Right near your homeland, Sort, is the nation of Arbitros. The elf folk of the southeast are practitioners of more wild sorcery, and tend to make their homes high in the branches of the trees themselves. I've had the pleasure of spending time in both places. Sevilia is ancient, traditional, and organized. Arbitros is more chaotic, and in a constant cycle of rebirth."
The Beast Man described at length the similarities and differences between the two elven nation cities. Sevilia was ruled by a royal family, while Arbitros had an elected council that left power every 3 years and could never serve again afterwards. Sevilia had a fiefdom, while there was no concept of land ownership at all in Arbitros. Both elven nations had armed forces. Sevilia had a professional standing army, while all adults in Arbitros were expected to serve in the militia for 9 years, sometime between the ages of 110 and 140. By the time Toby was finished, we had been through 2 rounds of tea. Other groups were turning in for the night, and that seemed like a good idea to us as well. Before getting in our bedrolls, the Minotaur asked me,
"So what will the topic of conversation be tomorrow?"
I simply answered, "You." The morning was cooler than the one before, perhaps an indication of what we could expect further up the road. After helping the caravan workers to feed and water the horses, we went to our prospective wagons and set off. I decided to start the Q&A session soon after we had arranged ourselves in the second wagon. So, Toby, what exactly is a Minotaur? Where did they originate? Toby took out an armor polishing cloth and started to buff out his thick black horns as he spoke.
In ages past, just after the creation of elves, humans, and orcs, the gods of justice and light heard a cry. Looking down upon what they had created, they saw a group of elves all standing in a circle. "Why do you cry out for justice?" asked Aro Remset, the elven god of fair battle.
"The orcs and humans prepare to wage war, and yet we are not ready. For each of our generations, they have 4 to 5. They breed, and they make engines of war, and yet we have not had time to learn the ways of destructive magics. Is this just?"
Toby was doing the high-pitched little voices for the elves, much to our amusement. He switched back to his own baritone timbre in order to explain.
Aro Remset did not find this just. In those early days, the elves, mature at age 100 instead of 18 like the other races, were few in number. He decided that a deterrent was in order to allow for the fair development of the elf nation. "Behold the bulls in the field. They are brave, and though they prefer peace, they are ready to serve in times of war. Bulls, I command you, rise up and protect my people until they are plentiful and battle-ready."
The Minotaur wiggled his fingers.
"And so the Minotaurs were born, not as numerous as the major races, but able to be a force in combat from a young age. Well, young relative to an elf. Thus our age-long bond with the elven people. We provided protection in their time of need, and would again if the need arose. They treat us with respect and kindness. Should any Minotaur be poor or outcast, they are welcome in any of the elven lands, where they will be fed and groomed and well cared for."
As the morning stretched towards noon, Toby related the role of Minotaurs in history. Their participation in the 2 Great Wars, their presence at the fall of Poth in the northeastern desert, and their aid in the building of the Arcane University, to name a few. It seemed that Minotaurs liked to be wherever there was action. As we broke for lunch, I agreed to allow Toby to rest his voice. He could pick up where he had left off tonight after dinner, so long as Will and Rick entertained us during the afternoon leg of today's journey. They agreed, and together they recalled the most interesting customers that they had encountered in their shop since they last saw Toby. As our day's journey drew to an end and the sun was dipping past the horizon, one of the humans' stories was of particular interest to Toby. His ears perked visibly as Will told the tale.
"Oh yes, we saw another Minotaur in our shop recently. She was dressed mostly in leathers, with some kind of cudgel on her hip. Peace nodded, of course. She came in asking about divine magic. I showed her what we had in stock. We sometimes have healing potions, abjuration scrolls and the like. She bought one of the scrolls that we had and took the referral to our temple for more. Then she asked the strangest thing."
Toby interrupted, his tone very neutral.
"She asked about the Axe of McGrondle."
All eyes were on the Minotaur now. Will nodded slowly.
Yes, in fact. When I told her that I didn't know anything, and Rick also confessed his lack of knowledge, she started to cry. Why? I'm not sure.
Toby shrugged.
"Angry, I imagine. It has been her quest for some 15 years now, and she's not getting any younger."
"So you know her?"
Toby nodded, but he did not elaborate. I had to ask. Was she so angry she just started crying, like a high-stress situation? Rick chimed in.
"No, Salt, Minotaurs don't experience emotions in the same way as we do. All emotion to them falls on some scale of sadness or joy."
Will added,
It's called binary emotion. When we would experience rage, they would experience a deep sadness and a need to rectify that sadness. Love, to them, is just extreme joy. It's why you never assume a Minotaur's emotional state. You ask.
Toby, truth be told, looked a little sad right now. I asked him, "How do you feel?" The question startled him, and he perked up a little. He laughed. "Mired in the past, but I'm fine now, really."
Rick peered at the large paladin for a moment, then he shrugged. "Anyway, she left the shop and headed over to the temple. That was the last we saw of her. I imagine she's still looking for that axe."
Toby nodded. "She is, always." Just then we heard the call for a stop. The caravan had found a suitable campsite. Chores were doled out, and chores were accomplished. Our little group opted for our own fire tonight, needing a break from the communal nature of caravan life. We went through the perishables that we had left in our personal supplies before they had the chance to go bad. Bread, soft cheese, salted meats, and the last of the fresh fruit. The nature of the hodgepodge meal allowed us to snack and chat well into the night. "So," I prompted our resident Minotaur, "who is this Toby, and why is he here?" The burly paladin smiled.
"Right. Well, my name is Toby McGoldberg. This is my 67th year. I am a paladin of the Order of the Snow, a guardian of Ice House, Aro Remset's left hand, and servant of the old gods of good. But Toby is fine, if it pleases you."
He tapped his hooves lightly on the rocks that we had used to ring the fire.
"I was actually born in Ice House. My parents taught me what was important in life. Justice, defending the defenseless, beauty in the arts, and embracing the wandering. The wandering is an impulse all of my kind have, to travel, to adopt a quest or an ideal, to explore the world and the cultures of Panos. So when I was older, long after I joined the Order of the Snow as a paladin, I traveled. In the name of the Order and out of respect for the wandering, I made pilgrimage all over the Elven and Orc lands. Recently, my wandering became less compelling. I bought a house in Ice House, so I'm quite happy when my adventures bring me home."
I asked for a clarification. "What is the Order of the Snow, and how does it relate to your god?"
Toby nodded a few times, indicating that I had hit upon a good point.
"The Order of the Snow is a unified temple that combines the clerics, paladins, and militant faithful of several different gods. The pantheon represented spans all of the major races and encompasses the gods that are generally considered good. In essence, if you worship and fight for one of these deities in and around the Ice House area, you are welcome to join. It allows us to pool our resources to do a lot of good, while at the same time putting aside petty racial and regional differences."
With the foundations laid, I started asking detailed questions. I asked many, many questions.
Toby, like all Minotaurs, had a passion for the dramatic. He loved acting, poetry, parades, and grand displays. Toby had been an actor and a singer in a wandering troupe for a number of years prior to taking his oaths. By his own admission, he was average at best, but he enjoyed the experience tremendously. One thing that I appreciated about the Minotaur, he carried no prejudice in his heart, allowing actions to define how he felt about someone. He actually mentioned befriending a half-orc from the northern tribes and promised to introduce us should our path ever take us in that direction. Toby's wandering had taken him all over the continent. Every adventure that brought profit resulted in a tithing. Much like I set aside funds for my people, the Minotaur sets funds aside for his order. Most recently, the paladins of Aro Remset were gathering donations for the centennial celebrations.
In a couple of months, the Arcane University would be holding parades and magical demonstrations in every major city on Panos. Toby and his people plan to have grand representation in every parade, followed by a feast for the poor in each location. He explained,
I've been assigned to help organize the parade in Royal Moffat, the capital city in your Southlands. Hundreds of mages will be on hand to demonstrate their arts, but they do not have... How can I put this kindly? They don't have the kind of flair and pageantry that my people are known for. So we shall provide coordination, protection, and some amount of emergency services should there be any injuries. Accidents happen.
The Minotaur licked his fingers clean as he finished off the last of the cheese.
Anything else? I'll tell you more about Ice House when we get there. You must be sick of hearing my voice by now.
I shook my head. I'm not sick of it. Your voice is like a rumbled melody, but you've held up your end of the bargain. The bullman stretched.
Good. Then I think we should turn in. There's a small stream nearby, the last we'll see for quite a while. I suggest we all get a bath before we leave in the morning.
There was a lot of subtle sniffing after the Minotaur walked away from the fire. Silently, we all agreed with the wisdom of our companion's plan. Chapter 10. I hated to admit it, but the caravan master was right. The next couple of days brought us out of the somewhat bleak plains north of Limt and into the extra bleak wastelands of the former Grey Empire. 200 years ago, it is said that these plains were lush and arable. But on our journey, the soil was a dusty, chalky white. Only the most hardy grass was growing, and only in small, misshapen patches. To make things worse, the trip would be getting colder as we moved towards the mountainous equator. And of course, that constant slight incline leading up to the proper mountains would be a wear on the horses, meaning longer rest periods and more resources burned through. The good news was that in such a featureless area, the scouts could see out to the horizon in all directions. The bad news was that anyone looking to make trouble would see us coming an hour in advance. Easily enough time to set up an ambush. With that in mind, one might think that we should focus on scouting efforts to the north so that we would be more likely to catch out those looking to set up an unpleasant surprise for us. But most eyes were fixed on the western horizon. To the west, far out of sight but never out of mind, was Castle Grey. Rick told me all about the history of the place soon after I gave him the Electrum coins to sell. The Empire had died generations ago. The only issue was that nobody told its defenders. Armies of the Grey rose again after the mystical annihilation of their castle and the surrounding city. Some say that the last king of the Grey Lands, Sir Roden Belfast, had made a deal with dark powers and things had gotten out of control. Apparently mages from the Arcane University had tried to spy on proceedings within the broken husk of Castle Grey. After briefly seeing a giant mummified figure on a dark throne, their magical eyes were banished from existence, and white-hot pain was sent back through the magical link until it was severed. The upshot of this unfortunate set of circumstances? We had far more to fear from the dead in this place than anything alive. Toby had prepared for this leg of the journey, securing a few flasks of holy water from his order's monthly moonlight rituals. When the Minotaur told me how much silver is consumed during that ritual, I groaned. It was more than a year's worth of my material component requirements for augmented intelligence, but he assured me that the potent water produced was like a powerful acid to undead creatures. The holy water was poured into small clay pots, and then the lids were sealed onto the containers with wax. Each of the guard groups received 2 of these pots. Toby noted,
As long as you touch the undead or demonic creature with the pot, it will shatter. It will even work on ghostly creatures as the water itself passes through their incorporeal forms. The water wants to get out. It wants to purify the taint of evil.
2 days passed. Perhaps the real enemy in these lands was boredom. Or perhaps the enemy was depression. Either way, there was a palatable mood shift among the caravan members. Everything was more quiet, more somber. It was as if happiness might be seen as an affront to these lands and undead retaliation would be the result. I wasn't a very superstitious man. I believed that the gods existed, certainly. I saw that their followers had power, and I knew that dark forces existed as well. It was hard to deny in a world such as this. But I had no god that I would call my own. Unlike Shaman and his beloved Kenvunk, unlike Will and Rick with their revered Venora, and unlike Toby and his mighty Aro Remset, I lacked a personal connection with the powers that be. I never felt that I owed the gods anything. In fact, maybe they owed me a little something for the years of oppression and abuse that I suffered, oftentimes justified in their names. But even a skeptic such as myself felt a very real mental weight for no particular reason. It was as if the chalky earth had seeped into my pores and invaded my mind, making it sluggish. Maybe the air itself, smelling of absolutely nothing in a place with so little nature, carried some nefarious vapor into our lungs that made us forlorn all of the time. Whatever it was, even I had to admit that the effect of this place was very real, on a physical and mental level. I, for one, would be glad to reach the snow-capped mountains in the distance. The third morning in these desolate plains started like the last two. We ate our iron rations and drank our bitter coffee. The horses plodded along with as little enthusiasm as we had seen in days. The sun rose higher in the sky, but similar to the last two mornings, it didn't bring with it the usual degree of warmth or comfort. But today there would be a difference. Today we heard a shout from the rear wagon. The elves had spotted something. On the western horizon, a cloud of chalky dust had risen. Over time, the cloud grew. Something was closing in on us. Miles estimated that we had at least another 20 minutes of travel before we would have to stop and make preparations to receive whatever those things were. He went from wagon to wagon, letting each driver know exactly what was going to happen when he gave the order to stop. Meanwhile, the elves made good use of their keen eyes and scouting magics to give us regular updates as to what we were facing. At first, they were able to tell us that there were riders. The next update said that the riders were not human. The update after that said the horses being ridden were skeletal. Finally, a couple of minutes before Miles called a stop, the elves said that the riders themselves were skeletal as well. Lovely. When the undead raiders on the horizon were discernible to human and orcish eyes, Miles gave the order. The wagons were quickly circled. Cargo that could sustain a direct charge, crates of armor, weapons, and the like, were lined up directly to the west, while the more delicate cargo was situated towards the east. The horses were gathered in the center of the wagons for protection, as bows wouldn't be particularly effective against a creature that was nothing but bones. The elves and frontline warriors prepared for melee combat. Almost a score of the crew and passengers used slings to hunt small game and defend themselves. They were organized into groups situated on the inside of the circle, waiting to be called upon. Their heavy stones could be quite effective against skeletal opponents. Toby stalked out to the front of the circle of wagons. He was the tip of the spear. The armored minotaur was an impressive sight. I swear his broadsword and shield were glowing slightly, and the others noticed this effect as well. Toby projected an aura of confidence. The other guards were quick to array themselves around and behind him. The mages, myself included, crouched in the driver's seats of the three wagons on the western side of the circle. It meant we could fire over the heads of our comrades, and then, if necessary, drop down to join them when things got more chaotic. Everyone was in position now, but it would take another minute before the undead riders were in range. It gave me time to appreciate them, if appreciate is the right word for the queasy admiration that I had to grant the unfortunate creatures. They rode fearlessly towards us, never tiring. Their formation was even more perfect in death than it had been in life. A wedge of riders with rusted shields and tarnished longswords was followed by a group of riders with javelins and maces. All tallied, perhaps 100 skeletal warriors and as many horses were charging our position. Until the fireball hit. Rick was an accomplished mage and scholar, with knowledge of some of the most obscure artifacts in all of Panos. But when that blindingly bright ball of flame exploded inside the main mass of riders, it was hard to think of him as anything but a battle mage. He timed it perfectly, catching part of the lead group, but mostly focusing on the ranged minions towards the back. There was no force behind it. It wasn't an explosion in the traditional sense, only a sudden raging inferno. A dozen and a half of the creatures and their mounts went up like dry tinder. Well, that kind and gentle man that I had come to know then showed me that he was just as accomplished as his partner. A flash of lightning arced from his fingers, and in an instant, the undead army's left flank was decimated. At least 10 of the riders fell, sun-bleached bones splintered and smoking in the aftermath. Inside of the circle of wagons behind us, the living horses were throwing a fit as the loud thunderclap rolled over them. I waited. My job was spot control, identify people in trouble and help them, or identify important targets and single them out. Since the front line of skeletons was about to crash into our main fighting unit, there would be a lot of people who needed help very shortly. Though perhaps not quite as much help as I imagined. 30 paces from the impact zone, Toby stepped forward, brandishing his shield. The symbol of Aro Remset flashed golden as the Minotaur shouted, "Back to the hells with you!" I had heard of holy men turning the undead, but I had never seen it before. It was as if Toby's words washed over the charging skeletons and simply undid them. Bones fell away from bones, losing whatever unholy cohesion that they once had. Around 15 of the ancient swordsmen found their final rest. Mounts without riders simply fled, running back towards their home in the west. The paladin had single-handedly blunted the charge, allowing our wedge of armored men to engage on their own terms. It was inevitable that the undead army had their chance, and now was the time. Javelins arced in and struck our fighters, most of them repelled by their armor and shields, but some of them finding softer flesh. The cries of our people triggered a kind of cold rage inside of me. So it was with a certain cruel pleasure that I shouted, "Fire!" From the tops of some of the nearby wagons, our slingers sent stones arcing into the back line of riders. Having spent their first volley of spears on our warriors, they couldn't retaliate against our unarmored second line. Heavy rocks rained in, smashing into several of the javeliniers and taking a few out of the fight. Our slingers slid back down to safety, awaiting their next opening. Soon after the exchange of missile weapons, I saw my first opportunity to help. The right side was getting pressed heavily. No fire or lightning had touched them, and undead swordsmen were going to overwhelm our warriors if nothing was done. I quickly dug out some spider silk from my pouch and fanned my fingers towards the enemy. My incantation was quick, and thick webbing glued riders to horses and horses to the ground. They would be stuck for some time, unable to press the advantage on the right flank while our warriors dealt with the current wave of foes. With the adrenaline of battle, I hardly felt the drain. But with each spell, I knew that I would be less reasoned and probably more aggressive. Swords and axes chopped through brittle bone. Undead warriors were sent to their final rest, and their mounts soon followed. At the head of our warriors was Toby. The bullman's massive broadsword flashed in the morning sun, sending white shrapnel and the dust of long-dried marrow everywhere. Everyone around him seemed inspired by the sight, and even those who were wounded fought on bravely. Will and Rick sent tiny mystical darts into the back line, disabling two more of the javeliniers before they could heft their next missile. I opted for helping the front line's pressured right flank. Picking up one of the pots of holy water, I hurled it at one of the more massive mounted skeletons. Even with the advantage of high ground, I missed the main target. The creature's horse was not so lucky, however. The pot shattered against its right flank, and the mount's pelvis and femur melted in spectacular fashion. The huge undead rider was thrown to the ground as its horse perished, evening the odds. A javelin tore through the wagon's covering to my left, and a second one embedded into the wood of the driver's seat. Further to my left, I heard a cry. "Rick is down!" It was Will's voice. A few moments later, and a strange fog rolled in over the two caravans that the partners had been manning. The smaller human had created cover so that he could help our ally. I was upset and wanted to rush over to my friends, but the analytical part of my mind took over. Two mages were out of the fight, as one took care of the other. I needed to step up. I channeled my anger into a single word. Fire! Having spent their volley on the mages, the ranged skeletons could only watch helplessly as another cloud of heavy stones arced in and smashed into their dwindling numbers. I saw motion off to my right, much closer than expected. One of the unliving swordsmen had started to claw and crawl its way up the side of a neighboring wagon. I pointed and hissed out the words to my second oldest spell. I watched with satisfaction and a growing sense of bloodlust as the creature was hurled to the ground and shattered by my force bolt. At this point, the mental drain was somewhat desired. My bloodlust was rising, and I was welcoming it. Toby was helping to shore up the right flank now. The elves were dragging a human back towards my position, the young warrior too injured to carry on. I helped to haul the bleeding, semi-conscious fighter into the passenger seat, and then handed the taller elf my last pot of holy water. There was a flash of begrudged respect in his eyes before he turned to rejoin the battle. Shortly after, I saw a skeleton melt away just before it could deliver an overhead blow that would have surely killed someone. Just as I was feeling some relief that I had perhaps saved a life, I spotted something. Walking calmly towards the front line was a creature unlike the others arrayed before us. It was wearing coppery-scale mail armor that had not deteriorated from the ravages of time. It carried no shield, just a battle axe that was strangely purple in hue, and it stalked towards Toby from the nearly bare left flank. The thing was moving with intent, as if it was on a mission. I did some quick mental calculations. I didn't see any way that Toby could face this thing and still hold the line. It was up to me. "Fire at will!" I shouted, realizing that if we didn't engage the remaining javelineers, nothing Toby or I did was going to save us. Freed from my other obligations, I opened up on the creature. One might assume that this was some kind of a war chief for this otherwise mindless band of undead. I palmed what I needed from my pouch. The beetle guts melted in my fingers and formed the acid bolts that sailed across the battlefield and into the creature's chest. They melted through armor and into bone, causing the creature to open its jaw in a silent, enraged scream. I had its attention. The drain was very real this time. My higher reasoning was melting away. It was being replaced with rage. Rage at the uncertain fate of my friends. Rage at the pointlessness of fighting an army that died over a century ago. I found that it was easier to be angry when I was dumber. Sometimes logic was overrated anyway. I dropped down from the wagon and stalked across the bleak plain. First, I conjured my invisible shield as the distance closed between me and my foe. The burnt stick was in my right hand a moment later, and with my final spell I summoned a fiery cutlass. I was blind to the desperate melee taking place behind me and to my right. I was deaf to the whizzing of slingstone as they peppered skeletons in the distance. I was a primitive once more, drained of all that useless mental capacity. Now, I wasn't the best swordsman in the world. It was fair to say that even though it was dead, the war chief had an advantage. We spent the better part of 20 seconds circling, probing for weakness. The skeleton committed first, and I barely raised my invisible shield in time to keep my head attached to my shoulders. The strength this thing had was unreal. That single impact had numbed my forearm. It followed up the first attack with a series of chops that might not have impressed a warrior, but would make any woodcutter proud. It had opted to power its way through me, and so far it was working. I staggered backwards to avoid a wild slash, shield blocked a thrust with the axe's spiked tip, then half parried the next blow, allowing most of the force to travel past me. My riposte just bounced off of its armor and sent cinders flying every which way. The undead war chief seemed to have learned what it needed to know. The next swing was parallel to the ground, and I misjudged how low it was sailing. Some of the force was absorbed by the very bottom of my shield, but the remaining momentum carried the edge of the blade into my left hip. There was a spray of blood, a sickening thud of steel on bone, and a flash of white-hot pain from the tips of my toes to the base of my skull. My return blow was already in motion as the skeleton's attack connected. I had been aiming for its exposed femur, but as I screamed and fell, the arc of my blade caught the creature's tibia. There was a flash of flame as the full weight of my falling body got behind the counterstrike. We fell in a heap. I was screaming, it was thrashing. The gash on my hip was bleeding profusely, and the left side of my lower body was not responding. The undead war chief was missing its left leg below the knee, and the axe had clattered away upon impact with the ground. My left hand had unclenched when I grasped at my wounded hip, causing the invisible shield to melt away. but I maintained the death grip on my conjured cutlass, despite the pain and shock, or perhaps because of it. I don't know what I was thinking, or if I was thinking at all. I just found myself clawing my way up the skeletal fiend's lower body as it tried to push me away and reach its axe. I saw the hole that my acid had burnt in its scale mail, and brutally thrust my sword into its body cavity. Suddenly, the undead war chief was ablaze. I quickly let go of the blade, causing it to disappear, but the mundane fire remained. As fast as I could with one arm and one leg, I scrambled away from my now burning skeletal foe. In a morbid and absurd race, it clawed at the ground and dragged its burning body after me, shrieking silently all the while. But before I could either pass out or the burning war chief could catch and embrace me in a final act of fiery vengeance, there was a crunching sound. I looked back to see a big hoof buried in the smoldering skull of my foe. Toby had made it. With the death of their war chief, the rest of the undead strike force immediately retreated to the west. There they could find a different undead commander and start the process over again, for the glory of their dead king. Any stragglers that could not walk or ride away were quickly crushed by our vengeful warriors. The rest of the morning was a blur. In fact, I don't recall much until the middle of that afternoon. But one thing I do remember clearly was being laid next to Rick, surrounded by a dozen other wounded folk. I glanced over and knew that he was worse off than I was. They had removed the javelins from his shoulder and his gut, but his chest was hardly moving. If I might bleed out from my wound, Rick's death was a near certainty. But then a huge figure crouched before us and blocked out the sun. There were no words at all. Two huge hands started to glow and were pressed to Rick's belly. Instead of the hands becoming bloody, the human's wound seemed to be infected by the glow. I had never seen a paladin perform the laying of hands. I knew it was a daily favor granted to them, but I didn't realize the significance. There were no materials exchanged, no incantation. It was just the raw power of Toby's god channeled through the hands of the faithful. It was beautiful. Then the Minotaur shifted his hands to my leg and side. They were no longer glowing, but I heard that low, silky, smooth bass voice murmuring a plea to Aro Remset. It was only a minor divine invocation, but I didn't care about the pedigree of the spell, as long as it worked. The bleeding slowed. The bone no longer felt fragmented. Some of the pain was gone. It was enough to help me find the sweet oblivion of unconsciousness for a few hours. When I opened my eyes again, I was packed into the back of our wagon, wrapped up in a thick blanket beside Rick. Will was chatting with the much weakened human at my side, and Toby was smiling absently as he watched me regain consciousness. I reached up with my right hand to touch Toby's chest and murmur, "Ruined." The Minotaur glanced down to see me touching his tabard, slashed to pieces and drenched in the blood of his friends and allies. He murmured comfortingly, "It's okay." "How many dead?" I croaked. The big bull man shook his head. "None, thanks to you." They relayed the aftermath of the battle to me. There were several wounded, many as severely as myself, but because of the magic shop's meager stash of minor healing potions, and because of the actions of Toby, Sister Janet, and a couple of civilian clerics making the journey, everybody made it. Like us, they would require bed rest for a few days because the healing was spread so thin, but Sister Janet proclaimed that no deaths in an assault of that magnitude was nothing short of miraculous. As the Minotaur checked in on Rick, I was treated to a visit from my small human friend. Will asked how I was, but I just gave him a grunt. He got worried and called Toby back over, and then I had both of them prodding me and asking me questions. I brushed them away, irritatedly.
"Me no like talk, when like this?"
The Minotaur raised a brow and looked at Will. The small human shook his head.
"Salt, you have nothing to be ashamed of. You're probably not going to be able to cast for a day or two. There's no need to take a vow of silence until then. Besides,
He shared a glance with Toby, who also said, I looked up at the two of them from my makeshift bed.
"What?"
I asked, irritated. The human sighed a bit.
You're sort of outed as an orc, my friend.
Toby explained quickly before I could get all worked up. Your hood fell off as you were crawling away from the burning skeleton, not to mention that your wounds were being treated along with everyone else, and it's hard to miss that your skin is green, even through all that blood. I threw up my hands in silent exasperation. Then I winced, because everything still hurt. From off to my right, I heard Rick's voice. It was good to hear, since just a few hours ago I would have written him off as a dead man.
It doesn't matter, Sorge. After what you did, these people see you as a hero, no matter what race you happen to be.
Toby was quick to nod his agreement. Even the elves said that your bravery should be lauded. Elves, complimenting an orc. I had to check if the sun was still moving in the sky, or if this was the end of days. I snorted, but relaxed. They must have seen it in my posture as the tension melted away from abused muscles, because there were faint, relieved chuckles at my reaction.
Anyway, that's about the size of it, said Will. The only things of value were the armor and the axe on the fiend that you fought. Everyone agreed that the armor should go to that young man who the elves pulled out of battle, as he could use the upgrade in equipment. One of the smiths and I will mend it, physically and magically, and then gift it to him. The axe has a minor enchantment on it, and the group said that we could sell it to make up for the healing potions that got used up.
Seem fair, I croaked.
In 2 days, I was able to start casting spells again without pain, thanks to Toby's constant care, as well as frequent visits from Sister Janet. A couple of days after that, and I was fully recovered from a mental standpoint. Nobody made fun of me for my heritage or for my temporary mental weakness. In fact, the only person to mention it was Sister Janet, who wanted to hear all about my life and document it in the caravan's history. I agreed to the retelling. Others listened quietly as I recounted my life and journey so far, but out of respect only Janet asked questions. I was more than happy to spend a couple of nights by the fire with her, watching her experienced hands stroke ink into parchment. The rest of the journey transpired without major incident. Ashy plains melted away, and with them the ominous foreboding of the land of the dead king. Snow dusted the ground as we climbed into the foothills. Each day was colder, crisper than the last. The morning of the first snow, Toby looked a little sad, so I asked him,
"What's wrong, my big friend?"
The Minotaur sighed.
"I love my home, but now I have to wear boots again. I hate boots."
Eventually, hills gave way to mountains, and there was ankle-deep snow in every direction. Hunting picked up again, and the occasional rabbit or fox would supplement our dry meals. The last day was slow going, as fresh snow was falling. Rather than make camp for the night, we ate and then were told to mount back up. Miles said that the crew would press on into the wee hours so that we could reach their permanent camp outside the city. They had both mundane and magical means to light their way. He told us all to get some rest on the wagons, and by dawn we would be at the destination. We bid our farewells to everybody that night, as much of the crew would likely be asleep when we waked, and the other guards and passengers would likely have their own schedules to keep. Sister Janet granted us her final blessing and told us that she looked forward to seeing us again in the future, if fate was so kind to allow it. The four of us climbed into our wagon and bundled up. Four people couldn't lay out recumbent in the free space available, but three of us could sit up in comfortable little blanket cocoons and still give Toby enough space. I was almost excited enough to stay up all night, but after 3 weeks on the road, I was feeling quite exhausted. Nature won out. I closed my eyes, knowing that when I woke it would be the first day of late fall. After what dreams might come, I would be in the heart of Ice House, the city of adventure.
Chapter 11. Icehouse's southern gate was much like Limp's northern gate, just colder. All of the larger caravan companies had built permanent offices here. The alcove, an area that referred to the wide open space outside the gates where multiple caravans could load and unload, was well policed by both company and city watchmen. By the time we woke, most of the staff was inside the ASC barracks, catching some much-needed sleep. Their compatriots, based here in Ice House, were doing the inventory and unloading shipments that the company was responsible for. After much grumbling and groaning, we managed to emerge from our relatively warm cocoons. Will had thoughtfully provided a coat for me to wear over my cloak, a detail that I wouldn't have remembered. We joined the queue of people inside of the advanced scouting and commerce warehouse, waiting for them to sign off on a job well done. Miles was there personally to shake our hands, and we were invited back any time. Once all accounts were settled and papers signed, our troop of four headed through the south gate and into the city proper. When I first entered Ice House, I wasn't sure what I would find. I knew it to be a melting pot of sorts, and on that account I was proven correct. Predominantly, the city was populated by elves and humans in fairly even numbers, but sprinkled into the population was a fair number of every civilized race on Panos. Orcs, of course, minotaurs, werewolves, werecats, halflings, lizardmen, and a host of other minor species. All of them bundled up against the cold, some of them looking wary, but nobody holding any obvious or open aggression towards me or each other. At least not in broad daylight or in the middle of Main Street. What I was unprepared for was the architecture. The entire city was surrounded by icy mountain walls, save for the north and south gates, which were hand-laid stone. As far as buildings went, there were four kinds of structures. Dusky gray stone, mined from the mountain itself, was a common building material for the older buildings. Lightly colored, almost white wood, was the material of choice for the newer structures. Over a quarter of the city was, surprisingly, made of glass. The thick glass buildings, undoubtedly summoned by elven magic, were the basis of agriculture in Ice House, serving as the city's greenhouses. Finally, ice itself was the most common building material on the outer edge of the city. Often these buildings were natural formations of some kind, and extended into the cave systems to the east and west of the city. The sheer amount of ice and glass gave Ice House its crystalline look and feel. I looked around in wide-eyed wonder. It was more ice and snow than I had ever imagined. The beauty, the purity of it all was unreal to me. More than once I had to be guided and tugged along by my friends. In short, I looked like a tourist. But in that moment, I didn't really care. Just then, I swear that I heard Shaman's voice in my head. "Is it wonderful?" "Yeah." Rick paused to ask, "What was that, Salt?" "Nothing." After walking down Main Street for 10 minutes, we turned sharply and entered a narrow alley. A few moments later, our party approached the rear of one of the old stone buildings. The sign hanging above the door said, amusingly, "The Spastic Vole." Toby was smiling toothily. Rick and Will were grinning as well. Clearly, this was a fun place of some sort. After having entered the establishment, I had to admit that I was a little confused. Clearly, there was a tavern aspect to the place. People were drinking and having a good time at the stone bar just to the left of the entryway. As I was led farther into the room by my friends, I became even more puzzled. It looked like the right-hand side of the Spastic Vole was a fully functional restaurant of some kind. The scent of wood-fired bread rolls and fresh roasted rabbit assailed my nostrils in the most fantastic fashion. My friends ignored my pleas to try out the local fare, instead dragging me deeper into the room. We passed through some heavy wool curtains. They were the only opening that allowed one through the wood and cloth privacy partitions that stretched from floor to ceiling. Clearly, the intention was to deaden the noise in this area so that it didn't reach the drinkers and diners near the front of house. This part of the Spastic Vole was less well lit. Only flickering torchlight guided us towards the back wall. We took a seat at one of the comfortable corner booths. "I promise you, Salt, we can still order food here," Will assured me. Toby snorted, "You can order a lot here." Rick elbowed the big man.
Don't ruin the surprise.
Fine, fine.
Seriously, you'll scare poor Sort. He's never been to the big city.
Fine.
I looked from the face of the Minotaur to that of the tall man and finally settled on Will as the friendliest source of information.
Will, why are there metal poles on that stage?
He giggled.
Oh, well, you know, Sort. They're props for our live performances.
I tilted my head.
What do you mean, our performances? You participate?
My question caused Toby to snort and bellow out a helpless stream of laughter. Will started slapping his shoulder to try and get the Minotaur to stop, to no avail. As the small human tried and failed to calm the bullman, Rick answered the question.
Not as such. Toby, Will, and myself are investors in this place. The main owner is our last adventuring partner, who I believe you'll be meeting shortly.
Will flagged down a waiter, declaring that the best way to shut up a Minotaur was to stuff his face. Toby agreed. A round of fresh-baked and buttered sage and thyme rolls appeared, followed by flagons of dark ale and a plate of roasted carrots and honey-coated chicken legs. The food seemed to melt in my mouth. All due respect to Will and Rick's cooking, but this was the best meal that I had ever eaten. As I sopped up the honey-pepper gravy with the rest of my bread roll, there was a raucous cheer. I popped the remainder of the meal into my greedy maw, and then looked around to see what the cause of this commotion might be. Up on the stage was a werecat. I had seen a few in passing as we entered Ice House. They were exotic creatures. The ones we had passed didn't make eye contact, instead cloaking their faces and moving quickly past. Then again, those creatures were more heavily dressed than this one. Rick slapped me on the shoulder.
Sort, meet Ames.
He had to shout to be heard over the whooping and hollering. Ames was dressed only in a thin gown of black cotton. The feline was covered in thick white fur from ear tips to tail tip to toes. In addition to protecting the cat from Arctic temperatures, it obscured any hint of Ames's gender. The werecat moved across the stage with the kind of lithe grace one would expect from a feline species. Each step was deliberate, firm black footpads meeting the polished wood of the stage with gentle precision. I stared, transfixed by the performance. I had to ask, is Ames, I should say, what gender is? Toby cut the question off.
We don't know, and amongst their people it is exceedingly rude to ask. There's some ancient history involved, best left to another time. They seem to know when confronted with another werecat, but with others, let's just say they'll let you know if they want you to know.
I nodded. For the moment, it would remain a mystery. Looking back up at the stage, I watched as the cat stalked up to one of the metal poles. Ames rubbed their cheek against the cold iron. Then the feline did something that made the audience whistle and shout. The cat slowly opened their maw and dragged that long pink tongue several inches up the polished metal rod. Such a display was more overtly lewd than anything I had seen before. I wasn't totally unexposed to sexual themes or expressions. When I was younger and times were better, there were nights with some of the unmated tribal girls. They definitely educated me on the basics, but it was private, quiet. Nothing like this. Ames scanned the room as they slowly circled the pole, one leg locked around it at the knee to serve as a pivot point. Will and Rick whistled and waved their arms. The cat's visage brightened and they inclined their head towards our table. I found myself on the receiving end of an intense stare, those deep emerald eyes seeming to drink me in. I felt like I was being hunted, for a brief moment. The dancer finished that slow 180-degree turn. With their back facing the audience, a single sharp claw was extended, and the laces holding that flimsy cotton garment together were sliced. When it fell away, there was more shouting from the audience, of course. Ames's fluffy white tail twitched and swayed above the fuzzy feline rump, which slowly shook and gyrated as the cat rubbed their body lewdly against the pole. That was when I discovered that I loved pole dancing. The rest of the dance was somewhat of a blur. I know that my jaw nearly fully closed, and I